you very much, Fred, for arranging all of this. This is great. I will likely take some food afterwards. But I explained, I don't eat before speaking. It's not bad manners. But I am Mordechai Turchiner. I am with the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, which is a long name for a fairly small organization. But we're, for those of you who are familiar with Yeshivat Or HaChaim, a boys' high school in the city, so that's where we are based. And part of our job is to work with the students there at the high school, and part of it is to be a resource in the community. And in particular, one way in which we are a resource in the community, try to be, is to present classes on professional ethics issues, the intersection of Jewish law and our daily professional lives. So we do a lot for doctors, we do for lawyers, and so on, and we have business-related classes, and so I'm grateful to Michael Mammon, who will be here soon, I think, for arranging this with Fred, as an opportunity to speak about a topic that ultimately everyone has to deal with, and that is the topic of estate planning, and specifically estate planning from a Jewish perspective. So, you know, when I talked to Fred about it, and I will note, by the way, the class is being recorded on video and audio, and those do go online. No one here has to worry about their face being on it. The camera is pointed towards me. But if you want to be able to get the link afterwards to download it, I would be glad to provide it. Perhaps Fred will provide in a list so that I can email it to people. Or alternatively, you see at the top of the handout, you see my name and email address, and you can always email me afterwards for access to the audio or video. Okay. So when I talked to Fred initially about the session, Fred was the one who came up with the idea that we should talk about estate planning, but it's such a broad topic. So he started listing different subtopics we could talk about, anything from the issues of the ethics of a bequest and deciding who to whom to leave and how much to leave to them, to the technical question of creating a will that will satisfy Jewish law, to the health issues that come up and healthcare proxies, to child custody questions, like all sorts of stuff. I mean, really, you could start on this topic and never stop, but we're supposed to be here for 45 minutes, so we are going to have to stop at some point, which means that I had to narrow it down a bit to a few choice topics, and I thought what I would do, and ran this by Fred the other day, is offer the choice to the people here in terms of what we should focus on first, recognizing we're not going to get through everything, so at least let's get through what people want to hear about. So I have three overarching topics that are represented on the source sheets that are in front of you, and I actually have a few extra source sheets here for anybody who wants. The first that you see there is ethical issues within bequests. The question of whether from the standpoint of Jewish tradition, one should want to leave assets for one's children. And, that sounds like a surprising question, but when you see the sources, you realize, no, there's actually quite a bit of discussion about this. Is it a good idea to leave it for them? Should I be prioritizing giving it away? Should I be prioritizing spending it myself? If I am leaving them something, do I have full discretion as to how to leave it to them? Choosing to give more to one or more to another. So that's one category we could discuss. Second category is the issue, the technical problem, which is essentially that within Jewish law, the rule is that when somebody passes away, their property automatically goes to their children in the order specified biblically, which is not necessarily going to match what somebody wants. And so the question is, how do you construct a will that will be effective in the eyes of Jewish law? And that's a second category we can discuss. And then the third category I have on here is health-related instructions, DNRs, and the question of, in the event that somebody loses capacity, who makes the decision on healthcare questions, and by how do they make those decisions? So, in a nutshell, to sum up, we have a choice of starting with, and we'll get to more than one of these, but starting with either the ethical issues in bequests, the practical issue in bequests, or health-related instructions. So I'm going to ask one, two, or three from people and see if we can get a consensus for any one of them. Starting with the ethical issues in bequests. Okay, that has a few hands. Starting with the practical issues in bequests.
I'm not sure.
Okay, that is a few more issues.
They all sound good.
That is a couple more hands. And you can vote for more than one.
Why don't you choose maybe one or two from each section?
Because then you won't get a full... I thought about it, but you won't get a full picture then. It just leaves a misimpression then.
Okay.
And then the third possibility is the health-related instructions. What's the... Okay, so I'm going to start with what I consider to be the dullest part, which is the practical one, because that's the one that got the most hands, and then we'll move on from there to one of the other topics. So we're going to start with the technical issues involved in the bequest. And you know, for those who aren't into technical, so this isn't going to appeal so much, but we'll get beyond this to the others as well. So if you take a look on your sheets, if you flip to the second side, and I see they were profligate with the paper here. I said double-sided. We got single-sided here. Okay. If you turn to source number 15, and I've provided the Hebrew as well as the English so that those who have the Hebrew capacity can see it in the original, but the English works well. Those are my translations, and therefore, of course, they are 100% accurate. If you take a look at source number 15, you find what the problem is. And again, for those who are just joining us now, we voted among the topics, the three topics that we have here, because you can't get to all of them. And not a huge majority, but the majority wanted the second topic to be our first point. So technical issues in bequests. And here is the source that shows the problem. Source number 15 is what's called in Hebrew the Shulchan Aruch. In English, it's called the Code of Jewish Law, codified by Rabbi Yosef Karo, writing in Israel, in the city of Tzfat, in the very end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th century, right after the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, in an attempt to provide what he felt would be an easy-to-read text that you could review on a monthly basis, and you would know all of Jewish law. Which is kind of comical when you read it, because really, you can't review this on a monthly basis. It's huge. Nonetheless, that's what he said. And then Rabbi Moshe Isserlis, writing in Poland, added to it, because Rabbi Karo came from Turkey originally, and then landed in Tzfat in Israel, and he represented pretty much Sephardic tradition. Rabbi Isserlis, writing in Krakow, Poland, added Ashkenazi perspective to it, so that the two together are now known as the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. So take a look at source number 15, please. Do you have sheets? Oh, you don't have sheets. You've got to learn something here. I have more here for anybody who does not have. So the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, writes the following. Barisha Amar Kisvu Utinu Sada Zula Ploni. If a healthy person says, I would like you to record a deed, right? Record a document and give this field to so-and-so. Record a document transferring my field to so-and-so. Im mechayim, if he is alive, kosvim v'nosnim, then you write the document and you hand it over and finish, then the transfer is done. However, the key part is what's coming next. Aval achar misa, towards the end of this source, after he passes away, ein kosvim v'nosnim elam ken kanu miyado. If he passes away, they do not record the deed and transfer the field. If a person says, I would like some of my property given away, but he passes away, you can't give it away posthumously. The exception, as noted in source 15, is where they did something called a kinyan. Anybody know what a kinyan is?
Acquisition.
It's really more technically in the way it's used here, although it is often referred to that way. Thank you. It's an act that effectuates transfer. Okay, it is a physical act. Think handshake, although that wasn't originally one of the acts of kinyan. But think handshake. It is an act with which you confirm your willingness to participate in a transaction, and it actually affects the transaction. So if you did that while he was alive, great. Then your transaction is done. But if that wasn't done, then you can't give it away posthumously. And that's the problem of how one would write a will that will be effective from the perspective of Jewish law. So what do we do? Well, the truth of the matter is that there are authorities in Jewish law who say a regular will, plain old secular written will be effective. And the reason for that is twofold. Number one, the standard language that's used in a will, something along the lines of I hereby give and bequeath, is not a statement of I will, it's a statement of I do now. So that even though the property will be transferred after the person is gone, Nonetheless, it's as though they're doing it now while they are alive, and that's one reason why it will be accepted. What about the lack of this act of kinyan, this act of transfer? What am I supposed to do with that? So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was a major authority in Jewish law in the latter half of the 20th century. He passed away in 1986. He was born in Russia, came over from Russia mid-century, and lived on the Lower East Side in New York, and everybody approached him from all over the world with questions of every variety: medical ethics, business law, ritual issues, you name it. He was considered in North America the last word. Until he passed away in 1986. So he presented a view here, which I excerpted a line from it in source number 16, in which he said, Be'etzem mistaber lefi aniyut dati. He says, it's logical in my humble opinion to say, Shetzava'a kazu, shevada yitkayem kedivrei ha-mitzaveh bedina demalchuta. He says, a will like this, which is certainly going to be upheld in court, by the law of the land, ain't sarach kinyan. He says that requires no act of transfer. He says ain't lacha kinyan gadol mizeh. He says there's no greater act of transfer than the fact that you created a document which the courts are going to accept. Remember that within Jewish law, we have a principle called dina demalchuta dina, which means
the law of the land prevails.
The law of the land is the law, exactly. The law of the land is binding unless it tells a Jew to actively violate the Torah. So if they create a law saying you must eat ham sandwiches on Wednesday, sorry, law of land is not binding in that regard. However, in the absence of a conflict, we are going to accept what the law of the land says, and we will honor it, and therefore, since the law of the land says we accept this will as binding, Rabbi Feinstein said, what do you need a handshake for? Why do you need to perform an act of kinyan while alive to transfer it? You already did that by creating a document that's going to get honored by the secular system. Everyone follow? So Rabbi Feinstein said, you're done. This topic is over. We can move on to the next. However, not everybody agreed. Surprise. We are Jews. There's no reason why Jewish law should be unanimous. So what we do have, and the truth is Rabbi Feinstein himself knew this was not a simple approach, even though it sounds simple when I excerpt a sentence and a half out of his responsum. Anything can sound simple when you excerpt a sentence and a half. It is more complicated than that. So there are three solutions that are classically recommended for this situation. And again, for those who are not technically minded, that's okay. We're going to get to some other items in a little bit. But first, let's do the technical, because that was our first topic and that was requested. The first solution is what's called a gift with retained life interest. Meaning, you're giving the gift now to whoever it is you want to have receive it. However, you retain, currently and for the foreseeable future, some sort of ownership / ability to use it. That's what we're saying. And I'm not getting into now, from a Canadian law perspective, what is involved in a retained life interest. But right now we're talking about it from a Jewish perspective. Take a look at source number 17, please, where they describe a gift that one gives to one's children that one wants to have effective only after he's gone. Hakosim nchasav livno la'achar moso. For those who are familiar with Ashkenazi and Sephardi accents, you will notice I am vibrating back and forth between them. I'm trying to satisfy everybody, so we're getting both here. Hakosim nchasav livno la'achar moso. If a person writes his assets to his son or to his kids after his death, meaning he says, I want this to be a gift for them when I'm gone. Harei aguf shel ben mizman hashtar. So he says, if you really want that to be a gift, where you're saying right now it's theirs, but it's going to take effect after death, he says, the body of it belongs to the child from the time on the document itself. What about the produce that grows in the field, if you're dealing with land? So, v'aperos la'avad shayamus. The produce belongs to the father who's writing this until he dies. In other words, he's creating a gift now in which the body of the land is given to the child right away, but the father retains the interest of being able to benefit from it by eating the fruit until his passing. Lefichach ha'av eino yachol limkor. Therefore, the father is not able to then sell the field anymore, mibnei sheheim nisanim leben, because it actually belongs to the child. On the other hand, the child can't sell it off either because it belongs to the parent in the sense that the parent has the right to the produce. So this is the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law in the beginning of the 16th century, end of the 15th, beginning of the 16th, documenting a gift with retained life interest. The truth is, he didn't invent it. He had it from earlier times. Jewish law has been dealing with this issue for a very long time. This is not something that was born yesterday. There are certain challenges, though, with this. Number one is that it takes effect immediately and potentially irrevocably. Right? What if somebody wants to, at this point they're feeling, this is how they want to assign things. But then 5 years from now they change their mind. Too late. You did your gift. It sounds like it's irrevocable. So that's one problem. There is such a thing, I know, within secular law as something that could be revoked. But within Jewish law...
It's the will.
Sorry. Well, that's true. But even within gifts, there is such an idea. But within Jewish law, we don't have that. You gave it, it's given. That's one problem. Second challenge is, it only works with property that you own at the time of the transfer. Let's say somebody wants to say, 33% of my estate is going to my daughter. You can't give 33% because there's nothing you can point to and say, this is what's being given. So there's a challenge when it comes to dealing with this. This is a good solution where you know what you're talking about. You know your item and you're not concerned about changing your mind. But it's not flexible enough to deal with many situations. Yeah?
So there's some question. Why is the rights to the produce of the field assigned to the father and the land itself assigned to the child? Shouldn't it logically follow to be the opposite? That until the father dies, that he has the land and his son owns like a trust, will benefit from that land. And then as soon as he dies, okay, fine, the land and the benefit would pass on to the child. Like, it just seems like a logically that it should be vice versa.
Right. So if we were to structure, you could structure it however you like. Meaning you could create just as easily a structure in which produce goes to the child and the land upon the person's passing. The problem is that won't work in the context of trying to subvert, essentially, the Torah's order of inheritance, the biblical order. Because if you do it that way, the land doesn't belong to the child until after the father passes away. It's too late. When the father passes away, it automatically follows whatever the standard biblical order is. What they want to do is defeat that. And in order to defeat that, they need to give the land now while the father is alive. So that's why they would design it this way. The father just says, I want to be supported, so therefore I'm going to keep I'm going to keep the produce for myself, but I'm assigning the land to the child now.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about a situation where the one who's entitled to inherit the produce while he's alive doesn't maintain it and doesn't get out of it what he should? He incurs costs rather than incurring income.
Yes.
What happens in...
And the answer is, this is real life. Meaning, if he incurs costs because he decides he's going to invest in the field and he doesn't get back what he invested, that's the risk of doing business. His decision of, I'm transferring the land over to my child but I'm just getting the produce, could well come back to bite him. And in numerous ways it could come back to bite him, not just in terms of the situation you're posing, in which he invests in it and doesn't get. What if his child ends up mistreating him? The child says, look, I have the land now, and now I can do whatever I like and not worry about what they think of me. That can happen also. This is a very risky way of addressing it for the reasons you point out, and more so.
I would just also point out, which I think the accountants might appreciate, that although we're talking about it from the perspective of Jewish law, if you wanted to make a gift like this, any sort of gift under Canadian law, right, is going to have tax implications of the disposition.
You bet.
So I think people sometimes think, oh, I'll just, make this gift, but even if you're only making a partial gift of, an interest after your death, that still has value, and if there's, a gain to that, you get a capital gains tax right then, and it's not necessarily so simple on valuing what the disposition is.
Right. So this is absolutely true. One has to consider the fact that any document one is going to create, even though it's created within a Jewish context, is going to have practical applications beyond the Jewish sphere. You know, this comes up in all sorts of comical ways at other times. For example, the familiar practice of Jews who do not want to get rid of all of their leaven, all of their chametz before Passover, so therefore they sell it to a non-Jew, right? So, you know, if it's the box of Cheerios that were in the pantry, so that doesn't have such great ramifications. What if you're a caterer, right? Now there are tax issues involved in this sort of a situation. It's not simple and straightforward. There are issues that can come up. So that actually is discussed. The Passover issue is discussed. But here, the answer is fairly straightforward, that yes, one would have to take into consideration the ramifications, not only Jewishly, but also in the greater world. Yes?
If one writes his property, is that in a will, or did he transfer deed? What is if one writes?
So the case there, they're actually talking about transferring a deed. They're not talking about it as a will, because they want it to be effective while he's still alive. So yeah, it's a deed. Yes, correct. Okay, let's get to the second solution. The second solution, remarkable solution, is to create a debt. And what that means, to say it outside of the text first, is obviously if I borrow money from somebody, I owe them. If I buy something from somebody I haven't yet paid them, I owe them. But it is entirely within my rights to simply stand in front of two witnesses and say, I owe to so-and-so. I owe $1 million to such-and-such a person. Notwithstanding the fact that there was never any loan and there was never any sale, there doesn't have to be. I can owe a person money for any reason whatsoever. And as long as I've testified to it in front of witnesses, there's nothing to challenge later. I made a statement. Unless I can come back later and give some reason why I was lying and explain, well, I said it because he had a gun to my head. That's a different story. But otherwise, I can create a debt for myself, an artificial debt. So take a look at source number 18. Also from the Code of Jewish Law, from the Shulchan Aruch. What I've tried to do here is to bring later codes of law as opposed to source text from which it comes in the interest of time. So the Code of Jewish Law records, "Hamachayev atzmo b'mamon la'achir," below tonight, if a person obligates himself to pay money to somebody else unconditionally, "Avo pisha lo hayachayev lo klum," even if there was no debt, he just made it up. He's obligated to pay. And they give you an example. Ketzad, how would this work? Ha'omer le'edim. Someone says to witnesses, Havu alai edim, I want you to be my witnesses. Shani chayav leploni money, that I owe so-and-so a money. Money is a classic unit of currency. You can fill in the blank with whatever unit of currency you wish. Osha kasav lo b'shtar, or forget witnesses. He wrote in a document. He wrote up a document that said, Harini chayav lecha money. I owe you, or I owe this person, a money. Avavi she'en sham edim, even if there are no witnesses on his document. Oshamar lo bifnei edim, or he said in front of witnesses, Harini chayev lecha mana bishtar, I owe you a mana with the deed that I have, with a document that I have somewhere. So in all of these cases, he is obligated. And if you want to know what's the precedent for an artificial debt, he tells you at the end, it's just like being a guarantor. Right? If somebody takes out a loan and I'm their guarantor, I didn't benefit at all, but you bet I'm obligated to pay. Right? That's the way it works. So too here, you're essentially becoming a guarantor for a non-existent debt. That's what it amounts to. So that's a second solution for the problem. Now, some will require that this involve an act of transfer, this act of kinyan that I mentioned earlier. Acts of transfer are not as simple as a handshake necessarily. Some actually accept a handshake because it's become popularly accepted as a sign of agreement, so some accept it under a category that's called talmudically situmta. Others will require other things, such as an act demonstrating ownership of a property, picking something up. If you've ever been to a Jewish wedding and you've watched what goes on at the time that they sign, so that the witnesses sign some of the documents, the tnayim, the ketubah, documents that are signed before the chuppah at the wedding, you may have noticed that they will take a pencil or a pen or a handkerchief and pick it up like this. Right? You ever see that? Okay. So what they're actually doing is first the officiant explains what exactly the husband is agreeing to do on behalf of his wife. As part of marrying her, he is obligated to support her, he's obligated in all sorts of things for her. And then he is demonstrating his acquiescence with an act of kinyan by picking up the item, whatever it is. The item itself is not significant except that it symbolizes the obligations he is accepting upon himself. That's an act of kinyan. So that would be required if someone wanted to do this, if someone wanted to create the debt. Now, I haven't actually explained how creating the debt works. What happens when one creates the debt is one says, for example, let's say, the biblical order of inheritance, which I haven't really explained much of, and I should have. The biblical order of inheritance, as explained by the rabbis in the Talmud, says the following. In the event that there are sons and daughters, if any of the daughters are minors, then we look to see the level of the assets that are there. In the event that there are sufficient assets such that the daughters could be supported and there is something left over, then the daughters get their support out of it until they reach majority, and the sons get whatever is left to split among them. In the event that there isn't enough for the sons to survive on out of that, the answer classically within Jewish law was, too bad. The community has to step in and provide tzedakah. You have to provide assistance for them. But the daughters have priority over the sons. In the event that the kids are all adults, so we're not dealing with that type of support, then the law is that the estate, biblically, goes to the sons. It was always given to the sons. The assumption was that the daughter is going to get married and then she will be part of her husband's estate and she will have land that way. That was the basic system. Like it, don't like it, isn't the point. That was the classic system. It is outlined biblically in the book of Bamidbar in Numbers, somewhere around chapter 26 or 27. So, what if you don't like that? What if you say, I want... You know, I have two sons and two daughters, so I would like them all to get 25% each. Let's say that's what I say. Oh, and I left out the idea of the firstborn getting a double share, which is also part of the discussion. So, first part of this is the ethical question of, is it right to subvert the biblical order of inheritance, which we haven't touched on yet, but we have the chance of touching on after we deal with the technical. But the other question is, how do you do it? So one way I might do it is what we've talked about already, the gift idea. But another way to do it is by incurring a debt. I could write up a document that says, I owe each of my children, and I invent a sum of money. Let's say I am fairly confident, who knows, but let's say I am fairly confident that whenever it is that I go, I will have less than $500 million in my estate. It's a fair assumption. So, I can create a document that says, I owe $125 million to each of my children with a debt created simultaneously. They all have equal claim from the same moment in time, and therefore, at whatever time comes that my estate is going to be divided up, they will each take 25% towards this $125 million, because that's all that's there. You follow? That would be the idea. I created an artificial debt, which they are able to collect. So once again, I said that you would require potentially an act of kinyan, and that's source number 19, which I will not read inside. You can see it for yourself. You will possibly require witnesses. There is one key drawback in doing this. What I described is a case in which I give a number. Giving a number is good. As opposed to giving a percentage. I owe a certain percentage of my estate. Some authorities do not like it if you word it as percentage. And the reason they don't like it is not entirely clear. I brought you some sources on the sheet, but I think in the interests of covering ground, I will say to you that you can look at the wording as it appears in source number 20 and in source number 21. There is some debate as to whether you can do it via percentage. I suspect the concern with doing percentage is that this is something called asmachta. Asmachta, in brief, is it's a case in which somebody makes a statement which should be legally binding, but they're not serious. and everybody knows they're not serious about it. So, for example, somebody borrows money from you. Okay? And it's a significant amount of money. They say they want a $10,000 loan. And you're not so sure they're actually going to pay back. So they say, I'm telling you, if I don't pay back, then you can take my house. Or if I don't pay back, you can. And they name some, you know, ridiculous thing that they're going to do. It's clearly asnachta. They believe that it's never going to come to that, or they wouldn't make any such condition. They're just desperate, and they're just saying whatever comes to mind for them. That's asnachta. In general, we want our legal statements to be grounded in reality. It is far less realistic to say to somebody, to say, I owe someone a percentage of my estate. It's much more realistic to say, I owe them a sum. Mm. So that may be one concern. The last of the technical approaches that I'll mention is a variation on that idea. And in this, which is brought in source number 22, Take a look at it. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who I mentioned earlier, writing the Ashkenazi portion of the Code of Jewish Law in the beginning of the 16th century, offers what's called a shtar chatzi zachar, literally a deed for half of a male. And what it means, as you see there, is that one writes up a document saying that his daughters should have a share like the males, or chatzi zachar, like half of what the males get. And he does it by saying, I owe a certain amount to her. And he says, my estate will not be released to my sons until they first provide this to my daughters. So that is something that that potentially works too. What you see there in number 21, where he says simply, I am making a statement that my debt to my daughter, I owe my daughter some insane amount of money. I owe my daughter $125 million. However, if my sons will give my daughter a certain percentage of the estate, then that debt is canceled. That's what you write up. And again, in that case, what Rabbi Isserles is saying is, that works.
Do you mean I owe my daughter, or my daughter owes me?
I owe my daughter.
How can you cancel a debt after you?
It's done with her agreement. In other words, you create the debt with her agreement and her participation in front of witnesses. She knows full well that this is what she wants.
Or she agrees to it.
Because it's either this or nothing. So yes, she agrees to it, and that's the way you work it. Now, there is some debate as to whether we specifically, the way it was formulated here is giving half as opposed to giving the whole thing. So there's some debate as to whether you can do a full share or whether we're unhappy doing a full share. Maybe that alters the biblical order too much, but that's the... But that's the guts of it. So again, our fundamental problem, to review very quickly, our fundamental problem is that there's no such thing as a gift after death within Judaism. Posthumously, you can't do it. It doesn't work. And you have a biblical order of inheritance that's supposed to kick in. Three solutions. One is the gift with retained life interest. The major flaw in that is that you can't change it afterwards, and it only works for items that you have at the time that you're doing it. Second approach is to create a debt, which has a drawback as well because it may require the amount rather than a percentage of the estate. So the third approach deals with that problem and says, I owe a certain amount to my daughter, but it will be canceled in the event that she receives X percentage of the estate. And that's another way to deal with the situation. Fred?
What does someone do in a secular law? They're always concerned about what happens if that son or daughter passes away. They're married, they're not married, they have children. What happens to that right? Is that still an obligation of the parent? And divorce is also a big issue. What happens is, I made this promise to my daughter. She was married, right? Now they split up. Now in the secular law, they may try to attack that asset and try to encroach on her rights. How does that all work in Jewish law? Can I write in my document, assuming everything is okay, I only leave this to you, and should you not be with us at the time that you receive the gift, this asset shall only go to your issue.
Right. So that's a really good question. By default, this gift would go to her heirs. in the event of, you know, in the event that she predeceased the parent, the gift would go to her heirs. There is the possibility of designing the initial document however one wishes. So one could design the initial document with clauses built in to deal with various conditions. I would highly recommend getting sound accounting advice as well as advice from a Jewish law perspective from people who are experts in this field, which I am not, to make sure that it's crafted properly and accounts for the various circumstances. Because I agree, you want to cover for those situations. It can be done. The answer is it can be done. Yes?
I just address quickly. I'm a lawyer who practices in this area, and so I've looked into this quite a bit, and I think maybe I can provide a little
bit of
an explanation here. So I think there are two things that are important to understand. One is that the more recent application of the third approach, it's actually been extended and to become much more flexible, which is instead of saying, I make this obligation, but it's canceled if you give my daughter a share, what you would do now is say it's canceled if my halachic heirs follow the terms of my secular will, which gives you the benefit of all of the different terms that you might want in a secular will as opposed to just giving a gift. Right now you could have trusts built in where the daughter, or also not just for the daughter, but all of the other kids have to become subject to the trusts, right? And it also means that if the daughter said, whatever, as long as, I can't speak to the halakhic obligation, but if you've satisfied the halakhic obligation, you're still going to be back in the will for whatever the terms are for her, what happens if she's not alive. So that's one way that it's become much A, more sophisticated, and B, a much better interaction with secular law, because
yeah,
it allows the secular law to basically come into play through this sort of halachic door.
Right.
And then the other thing I was going to say is that when I, in the sources that I've looked at, which are not the older sources, not like the Ramah, but more like the RCA documents,
yeah,
on this, and Rabbi Willig has written on it.
Sure.
From what I understand, the best way to do it is basically to understand that an obligation to pay is basically a pledge, right? I promise to pay you something in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And under Canadian law, a pledge isn't really binding without consideration. But under Jewish law, it is. So
right,
what you really want to do is create this document with a rabbi in Hebrew or in Aramaic. Don't put any deeds on it. Don't have any, don't worry about what, witnesses. Do whatever you need to do for it to be halakhically valid. But don't have consideration. Don't put a seal on it if you don't need to. Do whatever you need so it's not a document under Canadian law. And then, when you die, what happens is, from the Jewish law perspective, this deed is valid. And so if your heirs care about halakha, for them, this deed is valid. From Canadian law, the only thing Canadian law cares about is the will. So as soon as your halakhic heirs choose to follow the terms of the deed, which say, this is cancelable under Jewish law, as long as you accept it, as long as you carry out the terms of the will. So Jewish law is satisfied, and Canadian law is satisfied, because from the Canadian law perspective, the only thing that's ever been in place is the secular will.
Right, but you realize why they do that.
Yeah.
The goal of doing that is to avoid theft.
We'll have to ask questions across the floor.
Yeah.
By all means. By all means.
Sorry, I don't want to hijack. I just want to...
I'm glad to hear from someone who actually does this, you know.
In Canadian law, wouldn't a written document constitute consideration, even without a seal?
So no. Under Canadian law, if you want to make a gift without consideration, you can do it if you put a seal. But just writing it isn't enough. Like, there are certain formalities that have to be observed, and from what I understand, and don't hold me to it, I'm not giving anyone advice here, but from what I understand, that works for a deed, for a gift that would take effect now, but for a pledge, which is effectively a promise, and in this case, a promise that you want to be able to revoke later on if your wishes change, as far as I understand, pledges are not enforceable without consideration.
Consideration? What do you mean by that?
Consideration is getting something in exchange.
A dollar.
Something in exchange.
So one thing that solves is the following concern. Let's say there are children who choose either they follow the Jewish law the Jewish law order of inheritance, but there was a secular will, and according to Rabbi Feinstein, that's actually binding, or the opposite, you had a Jewish will, or a Jewish document, and they actually got money via the secular system, they could be guilty of theft. So what this does is it solves the problem. by creating your Jewish document in such a way that it's really sort of compartmentalized from the secular system, I think you've now freed them from that concern. It's an interesting approach.
Not my solution, obviously.
No, but it's a good solution.
But it's a good one.
Yeah. Yes.
Just with the various solutions that have been presented, I don't think I heard anything that covers the situation where you decide to change your will. I mean, you decide to do this, and maybe either maybe another child is born, or maybe you've chosen to give one of your children nothing.
Right. So in the event that you follow what was suggested as the third approach or the variation on it, and you say, I owe, and you name whatever ridiculous sum of money you want to name, and you say, which is forgiven if they follow the terms of my will, then whatever the will is going to, so you could change that will however often you wish. So that would take care of that situation. Okay. These are all very good points and good questions. We're at the 40-minute mark. I am fine for the next 2 hours if we'd like. But what I want to make sure to mention is that if anybody has to go, I'm not insulted and upset. And as I said, if Fred furnishes email addresses, I can send out the link where the audio recording and the video recording will be available, and then people are able to get it that way. But having completed the technical area, we now have two choices. Choice number one is to go into the discussion of health-related instructions. The alternative is to go into the ethical issues with a bequest, because what we haven't talked about, we've talked about different ways to defeat the biblical system of inheritance. Is that a good idea? And if so, how? So I'm happy going either way. If people could just vote, and that would help me. First, people who want to hear about the ethical issues in the bequest. Okay, I see a few hands on that one. Health issues? All right, ethical issues on the bequest. So, going back to the beginning of the document then, and doing this, I'll try to wrap it within 15 to 20 minutes. Yes?
Can I ask a question for you?
For a cousin? Absolutely.
So, you're talking about the biblical order of inheritance.
Yeah.
You're assuming people have sons or daughters. What if they only have daughters, or what if they have no children? What's the biblical order there?
So, if they don't have children, then it goes to siblings.
Okay.
It would go to siblings first. There's a whole, hierarchy for it, but that's the way it would work.
If they have only daughters?
If they have only daughters, it goes to the daughters. Only daughters, it goes to the daughters.
Even if they're adults?
Even if they're adults, I believe. Yeah, well, that's a land case, but yeah, I believe that's true. In the absence of sons, it goes to daughters, even if they are adults. Yeah.
Is there a procedure for siblings to challenge whatever documents, wills, or whatever you want to call it, that in the transfer of property?
Absolutely. The Beit Din system, the system of rabbinical courts, does indeed hear cases in which there is a challenge to the validity of an agreement, and it could be on a number of grounds. There are some differences, which we'll actually get to in the ethical point, between the way that between what's considered valid as a challenge in the secular system and in the Jewish system. The grounds for challenging are somewhat different, and frankly, they're even shifting within the secular system. But we'll get to that. But yes, absolutely, it can be challenged. Yes?
Are there requirements for the witnesses, like in Kedushin, special requirements?
Yes. You would need witnesses who would be credible within the system, which means that you require that they be people who are observant of halakha, observant of law. You would require as well that they be people who are involved in what's called, actually this is going to be one of the sources here, settling of the world. Meaning that a gambler can be disqualified. People like that can be disqualified.
Seems like from, but like a bad mina?
Like we wouldn't want from gamblers. That's correct. Religiously observant gamblers. They, as in, they roll the dice saying, God help me. No, the question of whether you would require, for certain things in Jewish law, we require males as witnesses. For certain things, it could be males or females. For this, I'm not 100% sure what you would need, whether it would have to be male or not. That's a technical question I'm not sure of.
So are you talking about witnesses for these documents?
For these documents. Yeah. That's an interesting question. I'm not sure what would be required.
They have to be frozen in terms of and of good character.
Yes. David.
With Glenn's question, in case the daughter is deceased and she has a husband and heirs, did you say it goes to the heirs? Is that what you were saying? As opposed to her husband inheriting her? How does that work?
So if she has a husband, then right. If she has a husband and children, you know, let me email the answer afterwards because I don't remember offhand, and I don't want to give the answer incorrectly. So maybe what I'll end up doing, Fred. I don't know if you have the email addresses for people here, but I can send you the answer and you can distribute.
Sure.
Or you can give me the answer.
They can all email their email address to Catherine.
Okay.
It's on the RSVP.
Right.
And then we'll send it
out. Okay. Yeah, because I'm not 100% sure, and I don't want to give the wrong answer. Okay. So let's look at some of these ethical issues. The first question is, should I want to leave assets for my children at all? And that raises a very interesting set of ethical issues. Number one, there are three issues, really. Question number one is, do children have a natural right to the family's property? Canada and Ontario seem to be confused on this front. They express different perspectives. On the one hand, there have been a number of cases out in British Columbia that have percolated across Canada to other provinces as well, which have established that an heir actually has a moral right to the family's wealth, and that parents do not have the right to disinherit their children for anything short of objectively abusive conduct. So there were a whole bunch of cases like this. For example, there was a father who was upset at the lifestyle that his son had chosen. He had two sons. He was upset at the lifestyle that one of them had chosen. And so he disinherited, essentially, the son who he disapproved of. And it was overturned. The will was actually overturned. That was not considered to be adequate grounds. When I first heard about this, I was preparing for a moot court case. That was a lot of fun dealing with that question. I was floored because I'm an American. And as an American, it's like, well, it's my money and I can choose to do whatever I like with it. But this apparently is a European philosophy which says that the estate is actually property of the family. And you don't have the right to shift it from one person to another person on your own. And I thought that was a really interesting thing. So from that perspective, it sounds like you're saying that the heirs have a right to the family property. On the other hand, if you really believe that the heirs have a right to the family property, why does the CRA get to levy a capital gains tax on an estate, pretending that it's a sale? Right? So I'm not getting a clear message from Canada and its provinces as to whether it's the property of the family or whether it's actually not the property of the family if it's being sold. Similarly, why is there an estate tax in Ontario? It doesn't make sense if this is the property of the family. So you could explain that it's not a philosophical inconsistency. It's simply an opportunity for the government to be able to fund what it does. I get it. But there is a source within Jewish tradition, and I brought it here in the beginning of the sheet. There is a source that suggests that, in fact, children have a right to the family estate. In source number one, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who I mentioned earlier, writes that if somebody instructs that his assets should be distributed, quote, in the best possible way, okay, what do you do with it if that was his instruction? So he says it means it goes to the heirs because there's nothing better than that. Why is there nothing better than that? So Rabbi Yehoshua Falk wrote a classic commentary to the business section of the Code of Jewish Law, and that's source number two. And he explained it's because the Torah's portion of inheritance assigns the heirs the right to stand in the place of those who bequeath to them. So in other words, it effectively means they have a right to the property. Having said that, there are a whole range of sources that are Talmudic, meaning they go back 2,000 years and more within Jewish tradition, that say flat out that there is no obligation on parents to leave money to their children. None whatsoever. If you take a look at source number three, there was a rabbi known as Reish Lakish, or Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, and when he died, he left behind a measure of saffron. Now, Kav is the term for the measure in the Aramaic, and that's a small amount. However, saffron was a very expensive spice. So this was something of some worth. And he applied a verse to himself, a verse from Psalms, and they left their strength to others, meaning he felt bad that he didn't use everything up while he was alive. He felt like that was profligate, that he had left something to his children. In source number four, you find Rav, one of the greatest sages at the beginning of the third century, saying to Rav Hemnuna, he says, if you have something good, you know what? You should use it. Because in Sheol, which is a term for the place where people go after they die, there's no pleasure there. And death doesn't wait. You know, and if you're going to say, well, I'll leave it for my kids, you know, you don't know how that's going to be used afterwards. Susan?
But if it's all for the kids, what about tzedakah?
Meaning?
If I want to leave some to children, but I don't want to leave it all to my children, which it seems to say all belongs to the family, how do I leave some to, let's say, a school I believe in, or a cancer society, or something that I want that's the money also to go to?
Right. So that's a very good question. The answer seems to be that within that view that says that it belongs to the children, that's not the role of a bequest. In other words, in their mind, in terms of Rabbi Falk writing in source number two, his answer would be that people give tzedakah while they are alive, and then if their heirs want to give tzedakah too, that's a wonderful thing, and they can do it in memory of the person who left them this wonderful estate. But that's not the role of a bequest in his vision. Hold the thought, though, because we have another source coming. You always anticipate. I know already from our Tuesday classes. But you'll see there's another way to look at this. But that's another approach. Take a look at source number five. This is a very important source. Shmuel, the sage Shmuel, who's also 3rd century Babylon, turns to Rav Yehuda and he says, Shinina, sharp one, do not be among those who divert inheritance, meaning to warp the set biblical pattern, even from a bad son to a good son. You have one who you disapprove of and one you approve of, don't do it. Don't disinherit the bad one. Because you have no idea what's happening in the future. You don't know where things are going to go. The implication is, though, that if you did know where things were going to go, you could warp it. That's the implication. So these sources do seem to suggest that you get to spend your money your way, despite what we saw in source number two. These future heirs do not have the ability to dictate what's going to happen with the estate. Now, the second question that comes up within this is it wise to give our children an advantage? Let's say I say that, no, my children don't have a right to it, but I want to help them out. Keep in mind, that may not be in their best interest. If you take a look at source number six, which is a lesson from Ketuvot from Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, this is more than 2,000 years old. Husbands, listen up. He says, if a husband takes a vow that his wife will never work, okay, he takes a vow, like, I don't want her ever to work. I'm going to take care of her, that's it. He has to divorce her and pay her the ketubah, which is a divorce settlement as well. Why? Because idleness causes depression. Now, the issue of it in the context of the husband and the wife and the marriage is a really good discussion, but not the point right now. The point is, you don't want to put them in a situation in which they have too much time on their hands. You don't want to leave them in such a strong position. And source number seven, I mentioned the gambler before. We disqualify a dice player from testifying in court. And Rav Sheshet gives one explanation for why. Rav Sheshet says, because they're not involved in settling the world. We want people to be involved in the world. In this case, he's disqualified for testimony because, frankly, he doesn't take money seriously. Someone who earns money is going to take his testimony more seriously because he respects the results of his testimony. Someone who gains it on this roll of the dice and loses it on the next doesn't look at money the same way. And that's not something that's healthy. So that's a separate consideration. So we have to consider that we don't want to give, even if we say they don't have a right to it, but I want to help them, we want to make sure not to put them in a position in which, as a result, they don't work. The last point within this is the tzedakah question. If you take a look at source number eight, about a sage named Mar Okva. Mar Okva was dying. He instructed, and this is also Talmudic, so again, this particular source is almost 2,000 years old, this story. Mar Okva was dying. He said, bring me my tzedakah account. He had a ledger. And he found in it 7,000 dinari siyanki, which are fine coins, that he owed, that he still wanted to give away. He says, you know, my provisions are light and my path is long. I have a long way ahead of me and I have very little merit. for the road, my provisions for my merit for the next world. So he says, I'm giving away half my estate. That's what he says. To which they challenge and say, wait a minute, you're not supposed to give more than 20% away to tzedakah. You're not supposed to give more than 20% of your income away, because we don't want to create a situation in which people will be a burden for others then. To which they answer, yeah, but he's going anyway. He doesn't have to worry about being supported in the future. So after he's dead, there's no such concern. Therefore, he actually was able to give this away. There's more to discuss about this particular story. But what it says is there is a notion of giving away tzedakah. Absolutely. But, and this is a key but, the highest tzedakah is that which one gives to one's family. I brought it here in source number 9. So if one has children who need, they come before all the institutions that we love and respect and cherish. So what I want to say, just to sum up this segment, is the majority of Talmudic sources seem to indicate that children do not have a natural right to the family's property. Even though they get it, if a person passes away, they do not have a natural right. That's number one. Meaning that, by default, they get it. But they don't have a right, meaning that the parents should feel bad about spending the money. It's the parents' money until the parent is no longer in this world. So that's number one. Number two is that, yes, you may say, I want to give my children an advantage, but you don't want to put them in a position in which they're not going to have to work. It's bad for their character. It's bad for their lives. And number three, that there is an element of wanting to give to tzedakah, like seen in the source regarding Mar Okva in source number 8. However, supporting one's family, if there is a need, would come first. Now, there is still one more piece to go here in terms of altering the order of inheritance in order to help some over others. I'm going to say it outside of the sources. Just because it's already we've been here for a long time and I feel bad. Sorry? No, people have things to do. I don't want to. Okay. What about where one's motivation is fairness? You say, I want to be fair. I have 4 kids. I want them all to get equally. The Torah does not account for another possibility. Let's say one of my children has 10 kids and one of my children has 2 kids. So maybe there's an imbalance in their needs. Let's say one of them becomes a star hockey player and the other one is, I don't know what, some other trade that's not as lucrative. There you go. Thank you. So in cases like that, you know, I may want to account for that. I may want to make sure that I support the ones who are in greater need. So how, you know, that's one possible motivation for rebalancing things. Another motivation might be to keep the peace within the family. And actually, Rabbi Isserles in source number 11 talks about that specifically and says, you know, a person might want to distribute the assets in order to prevent fighting among his heirs. I mean, frankly, I wish him a lot of luck. I've seen far too many cases. To think that just redistributing it is going to solve all your problems. It takes more than that. But that might be a reason for doing it. And then third is the person who says, I want to support good behavior. Now, we've already said that we don't approve of that. We don't like reallocating to support good behavior among one over another, because you don't know where things are going. You don't know how things are going to play out.
Do we mean by that after a person's death? Or say when you're older, then your children might change?
Well, either way.
Both.
Either way. Okay. But yeah, you don't know them, and you don't know what's happening among their descendants. It's a statement of great arrogance for me to say, well, I've decided that this one deserves and this one doesn't deserve. Yeah.
But now you're in life, you're retired, I'm 70 years old, I have a certain amount of wealth, and I can assess the situation. I have a daughter, she has a special need child, and I need to set this up now. So can I then give a gift before I pass? Right, so that here's the check, you know, here's several hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm giving this for purposes of protecting that child, And yes, the other grandchildren won't get this, but I see the data, I've assessed it, it's my money. It has nothing to do with the Yerusha.
Right. Good question. So, in terms of the technical issues we discussed, it's 100% fine. Right? There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It's a gift, and therefore it enters into none of the problems of wills. In terms of the ethical question, I think you're also fine. And the reason you're fine there, as we mentioned before, I didn't read the source inside, but it was source number 9, the greatest tzedakah is that which one gives within one's family, and that's a very clear and present need that's being identified. As far as the question of, well, doesn't the Torah have a system of inheritance? So I would note for you, a key source, which is source number 14. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein makes reference to it, but the truth is it's a very old idea found in ancient documents that date back more than 1,000 years. And that is that the sages recognized that there would be cases in which people wanted to give more to certain children, and what they said is, okay, but don't disown anyone. At least give a significant amount, and what significant is has to be indexed, you know, to whatever price index you want to determine what is significant. It's going to change. But the idea is that one needs to leave something. In source number 14, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein mentioned that in early documents they found leaving 4 zuz. How much is 4 zuz? You know how much 2 zuz is. You know from Pesach. A goat, right. You can buy a goat for 2 zuz. So 4 zuz is 2 goats. So at least leave each one 2 goats. The 2 young goats, anyway. Others want to suggest that it's a different amount. You have to leave more. That's not the point. The point is that even if one is going to say, I want to alter it, for whatever honorable reason, they should not create a situation in which they've subverted the order so much that someone is actually out. Make sure to give a significant amount to each. So to sum up what we've said in terms of the ethical issues, the children do not have a natural claim such that the parent has to feel guilty about spending it. Parents may want to help their children and should be careful if they are not to create a situation in which the kids won't have to work. They may give tzedakah to the community, but we believe that tzedakah for one's family has priority. If I am leaving them something and I want to alter the order, either with a gift while alive or in this other way, I should still make sure not to write someone out entirely, but to make sure to leave something significant to each. Yes?
I just want to ask regarding source 5. Mm-hmm. When Shmuel says to Rabbi Yehuda, sharp ones do not be among those who divert inheritance even from a bad son to a good son, what does Jewish law say about potentially putting a condition on, let's call him the bad son, and saying, you know, I want you to go to shul regularly, keep Shabbos, keep kashrut, and upon that condition being fulfilled, if you live a certain lifestyle, because I think that you're quote unquote the bad son, then, you know, this gift will be bequeathed to you, in terms of almost trying to change the behavior of one of the people that inherit the estate, one of the sons or the daughters.
Right.
That inherit the
estate. Very good question. So, a couple of thoughts. First of all, if it's a will, meaning it's after death, there's no authority to any such conditions and clauses, because it's already gone. The person cannot act beyond the grave. If it's done as a gift while one is alive. So one says, I'm giving you this sum of money and I'd like you to say Kaddish, or whatever it is. Jews have done that. And it fits the idea that children do not have a natural right to the assets. So I could attach, you know, whatever conditions I want to the gift that I'm going to give them while alive. Whether it's a good idea or not, though, is a completely different point. I think educationally, that's a very poor way to influence one's children.
Right.
I would put that one in the same category as, you know, if you date a girl who's not Jewish, I'll disown you. A person, which classically people said, right or wrong is not the point. Right or wrong is the point. This isn't the way to educate your children. If you're going to educate your children by saying, my will is going this way or my will is going that way, you've lost. You know, it's over. So from that perspective, I think that it's not necessarily, you know, advisable. There are ways to structure it, like with this gift while alive, in which case, yes, one could create such conditions hypothetically, but I think it's a bad idea.
With Kaddish, though, it's accepted sometimes that people will accept money to...
Right, that's not as
opposed to, let's say, like,
if you, I don't know, drink cold instead of milk or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Understood. Understood. People might do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Brett, thank you so much for hosting.